Welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Calabrese, CPG advisor and now founder of It's All Happening, an agency that helps brands with launch strategy. Tune in as we break down ways that successful female entrepreneurs are using to build their businesses. You'll hear stories of the people who make shit happen, overcoming struggles, and celebrating the wins. We cover how brands are taking products to market, tactics that work, things that have failed, and just lessons learned from out in the field. Whether you're looking for inspiration, industry secrets, or launching a brand, this is the place. Okay, you guys, I just hung up with Tabby and Mina of Tersh, the amazing new Afghani brand that they have positioned their first product around being a hot sauce. It is such a great product. I'm obsessed with it. They sent me some and I literally like dumped it all over a roasted chicken and vegetables. It's super craveable because there's lemon juice and vinegar. There's something about this like sour tanginess that you just kind of obsess over and crave. So their mom made all of their food growing up and they decided to launch this first product. They're positioning it as a hot sauce. They're not calling it necessarily a chutney or a spread. They're calling it a hot sauce. So we learn how they're going to market, how they're approaching retail. They both still have their full-time jobs because they want to go slow and they don't want to feel that crazy pressure to scale the brand if it's not right. We're talking about co-packers. We're talking about what the future looks like and really what's working for them on socials as well too, what they're talking about and what type of content is performing. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. They are so sweet and such just fun people. And I love how they're modernizing Afghani flavors. I think it's really, really unique and disruptive. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Without further ado, my conversation with Tabby and Mina, founders of Tersh. Mina and Tabby, welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. I'm so happy to have you guys here.
We're so excited to be here.
And thanks for having us.
So you guys are the founders of Tersh, which is a new hot sauce brand, as you call it, which I love. We're going to talk about the positioning as well. But Tersh means sour, tangy, or tart in Dari. And I have to say, your product like truly is so special and unique. I absolutely love it. I ran through a jar in about 2 days.
Let's go. That's amazing.
It's really, really good. So the brand is rooted in your Afghan heritage and your mother's amazing recipes. Obviously, she's an incredible cook. So as first generation, you guys were raised in a very food-centric household, and Tersh is how you're sharing your authentic global Afghan flavors.
That's exactly right. You're done. You're hired. You did the brand. I'm done. I don't need to say one more word.
Yes. And you guys are on a mission to really bring these traditional flavors into modern kitchens. And I just love how you're doing this. So
thank you.
Yay. Congrats.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's definitely amazing to be able to like preserve our mom's flavors. And honestly, Tersh also came from like a problem we were solving for ourselves a little bit. Yeah. I was thinking about how much I wish I had my mom's chutney when I moved to New York. I don't know why I couldn't dare make it myself, of course. God forbid, right? Yeah. And then I was like, wait, I feel like other people are also feeling this too. Like they move away from their family's homes, but they miss the tradition, the culture, the flavors of their mom's cooking. So it was almost like a solve for ourselves.
Yeah. Okay. So before we dive in, I would love to hear what the two of you are currently hustling for.
We're currently hustling for to get Tersh on more shelves and into more homes, but in a way that feels intentional. Like it's not just rapid growth, right, but something that's more sustainable. It's really hard to balance being in a small business and have like a really big vision, but we really want to build the community and network so that it lasts.
Yes. And I feel like you're doing a really good job of that, by the way.
Thanks.
Yeah. How about you, Tabby?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the goal. The goal is to be able to bring these flavors into kitchens. And so we're hustling right now to build our community and get as many people as possible to try the chutney, because we truly believe that once you try it, you're converted. That's it. You want it for life.
No, you are. And it really does takes you somewhere else too, because the flavors are so unique and there's that tang. Whatever it is, I don't know if it's like just the lemon juice, like
vinegar and lemon.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is. Okay. So it's the combo of the vinegar and the lemon where you're just like, wow, it kind of hits you in the face as this like extremely unique flavor profile that is just so good on anything, honestly.
That's exactly the goal. And it's so interesting you say that it reminds you of something, because we get that feedback quite a lot. I think there's a version of this amazing green tangy sauce in every culture. So I love that there's this element that when you're eating it, you feel nostalgic towards something. And everybody has said that. That's like been a really big point of feedback.
Yeah. Okay, before we dive into the brand and all of that stuff, which I can't wait to get into, I want to hear about each of your backgrounds and what was happening before Tersh.
I'm a full-time medical provider, specifically a family medicine PA. Yeah, so very different field than what this is. We've been working on Tersh for over a year and a half maybe. I was still in school while we were developing these ideas, and we just knew we couldn't launch it at that time. So we kind of pushed it back. Creating the brand and developing the recipe. And then finally, when I was out of school working full time, we're like, okay, I think we can do this. Of course, at that time, Tabby decided to move to New York. So it did make it more challenging. But I think it's really amazing that we have our foot on both the East Coast and the West Coast.
I can also go. I mean, I have a background in brand and marketing, and I currently work in tech, but I've worked in beauty for like 7 years prior to that. I've done everything you can think of, from like social media to creator partnerships. And now, of course, working on Tersh as a passion project. You know, we are both full time. We both have 9-to-5s. Obviously, Mina's schedule is a little different being a medical provider. But I think you had a question of like, what were we doing before Tersh? I think we just had more free time and maybe like more free weekends in general. And so I feel like because we work for full time, any second that we can get to talk or think about Tersh, our brains are doing it. I truly wonder like what I spent my time thinking about before the brand. I'm like, wait, what else was going on if it wasn't Tersh, you know?
So nights and weekends?
Nights and weekends
are dedicated to Tersh, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Every second we can get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's like a full-time hustle.
Absolutely. And like, I'm so like in awe of people that are able to, you know, do this and like quit their jobs and do it full time. Like it is a second job. It takes so much time, commitment and effort and energy. And so, you know, we are not there just yet. We're taking it slow. But maybe one day. I don't know about Mina. She studied her whole career doing that. So I don't know about switching over from a medical provider.
Maybe part time.
I think it's super smart to keep your full-time jobs while you're in this proof of concept early stage where you're like just starting to generate revenue and like build your community. How could you possibly live off this business just yet? You know what I mean? Like it's just impossible in these early days. So I think it's super, super smart. I love it when I see founders doing that.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's definitely really hard and challenging. It's a labor of love. But I think both of our eyes widened when you were like, you can't sustain your whole life off this business, because it's just not the reality. And if anyone puts that reality out in the universe, they're not telling the truth, because food is a very expensive business to enter. It's very hard to be profitable in the business unless you've got huge backing, investors, et cetera. And so we learned that obviously from the jump and from talking to so many other people. Hopefully one day that's like the goal for Tersh to be, you know, I always say it's like a million, trillion, billion dollar business and it's, you know, doing amazing and I'm so happy for it. But yeah, it's something that is slow and steady for sure.
Yeah. So how did you guys figure out, separate from the fact that like you both, you know, obviously you have an Afghani background, and Tabby, you mentioned that you were really, you wanted this product when you moved to New York, like you wanted your mom's chutney. So how did you guys figure out that there was like a gap or market, you know, like white space?
So we actually were getting a lot of feedback from family and friends that were telling us, you need to sell your mom's chutney. Like, this is going to be amazing. Like, we crave these flavors and all these like dishes when we go out to eat. And we're like, yeah, like, okay, yeah, sure. Like, and so we started to do research and we really like, we realized like, oh my God, there isn't really anything here that represents our culture, our heritage, our flavors. There is one brand, Mazza, that is doing a really good job of paving and creating that pathway for us. We're using them as like a good example of how to go about this. But that's it. Like, we don't really see any other brands. And we're like, we see so many other cultures, like Middle Eastern cultures, but not much Central Asian and Afghan cuisine, like flavors out there. So we really thought like, as long as we promote it the way that people are able to understand, then we are going to make this product something that is going to be remembered for a long time.
I think you guys are doing it in a very modern way. You're going about it in a way that's very digestible, like calling it a hot sauce. I was going to ask you about that later, but I mean, let's just talk about it now. So, okay, I love how you call it a hot sauce. Why did you decide to position like that?
We called it a hot sauce from the jump. And that's really because although Afghans refer to the product as a chutney, right? That's what Afghan households are known for. It's actually a word that can be easily misunderstood and associated with a specific taste or cuisine that maybe the average consumer is either afraid to try or hasn't tried it before. So they have literally no association with that word. And that's a really hard sell. Yes. That's a very hard thing to convince somebody to buy that's like, you know, in Indiana and that's looking online, right? Yeah. So hot sauce makes it feel more approachable, and spread isn't really the way we use it either. This is something that we like spoon, we drizzle, we dip it into absolutely everything. And so we think it's the perfect condiment in our opinion. Yeah. And it's so interesting because when we sampled this weekend, I actually referred to the product as like an herby, tangy green sauce with a kick. And that really reels people in before we mention anything about it being a chutney. So it was a very intentional move and I'm glad you caught it.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the first things, honestly. I mean, obviously I saw that on your socials that you were like, we're the Tersh sisters and we launched a hot sauce brand. And then you get the product and I'm like, oh, this is a chutney. Like this is like thick sort of drizzle sauce. But I just thought it was really smart positioning on your end because it just makes it so much more digestible. Because like, if I would have just been like, oh, like an Afghan chutney, without your marketing, without your faces behind it, and like just seeing, I don't know if I would have picked it up, you know, though I do, don't get me wrong, like I love exotic flavors and like different,
of course,
you know what I mean? I'm like a very adventurous foodie, but I don't know, just I think your positioning is like really making it approachable.
That was the goal. It's really a fine balance, staying true to the soul of Afghan food while making it digestible to new audiences. And so, you know, even our design was really thinking about that piece. Like we wanted this commercial feel with the labels and the design elements while also tying in some of the tradition, whether that's like Farsi written on our jar or whether that's like our caricatures that are in Afghan clothing. So trying to have that, you know, bridge that little gap, but also balancing and toying between Afghan culture super traditionally and then obviously modern kitchens and, you know, that commercial feel of a brand.
So let's talk about how you guys started. So you're obviously still in the very early days. How many months has it been since you officially had inventory and launched? I feel like it's like 6 or maybe less than 6.
Yeah. So we've launched on social media, specifically like marketing our brand end of February, but we didn't actually release the product until April. So it's been about a little over 3 months, I would say.
When you first started, how did you get things going? Like, did you have a co-packer? Did you set up a co-packer? Were you making it yourselves? How did the whole operations, what did they look like on day one or in those like in February to April?
Honestly, we started in our commercial kitchen and we're keeping it like that for right now. That being said, we are, you know, working very hardly to find the right co-packer. It is a very challenging experience to find the right person to work with. Not because there isn't co-packers available, but because there isn't really a blueprint on how to find them. That's number one. We've maybe cold emailed, cold called 60 plus, 100 plus, and talked to, I don't know, a fourth of those people on the phone and over email. And we're also being picky, which is maybe not a good thing, but we're being picky because we want to find the right partner that believes in our mission, that believes in our product in a way that we're not compromising so much on like flavors and the way that we can scale. Because there is a lot of compromising that happens when you scale a product. Specifically, something like a sauce that's a little bit more challenging. It's a little more tricky. You know, right now we're working out of a commercial kitchen and we're able to source fresh ingredients and we're able to have a lot of control over the iterations of every batch, which I think is super important. So we're in the middle of figuring out the right co-packer for us and doing some samples and bench testing. But I think it's a game of parallel pathing, or at least that's what we're doing. And I don't know if this is right or wrong, but again, that's just like how we're operating. But we're doing our commercial kitchen and we're doing the best we can to match inventory there. But we know that that's not potentially scalable for us because we work full-time jobs. So the labor alone takes so much time that we need to look into what it could look like to work with a co-packer. So we're doing both of the things at once.
Okay. How does that work though? Is the manufacturing being done on one coast or are you both doing it?
No. So it's going to be, it's being done in Southern California. My mom and I,
okay,
two-man show running.
Oh, you guys are incredible. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been a little bit challenging. Obviously, like you said, I have a full-time job. Mama Tush has a full-time job. So we are using our weekends to produce the product. Luckily, again, everything we're trying to do is slow and steady. So it's sustainable right now, but we know like at the rate that we're trying to get into like specialty grocers and boutiques, we need to scale and we can't do it on our own.
I know. And Tabby, you're so right. Like there is no playbook. There is no like formula on how to get a co-packer. Like my agency, we do co-packer searches for people and every single one is different. You know, people want to know, like people come to me and they're like, how long this is going to take? And I'm like,
it could take a year. It could take a year to find the right co-packer.
Like 3 to 9 months, minimum 3 months. I've done them in 3 before, but those are more like bakery straightforward co-packer searches.
Right.
But like I've also been working on one going on 7 months right now.
Yeah.
We probably have at least another 3 months to go. So it really just is, there is no like standard playbook.
No, I feel for them. And honestly, it's the right partner, right? You want to be able to match with somebody that feels like they get you and they are not going to push you to do things that you don't want to do with your product when you scale. So that's also been really interesting for us. And so we've talked to a few in Colorado that we're really interested in. And I feel like they believe in us and our mission, which is like really exciting when you're so small because you're just like two girls that are just like, please take our sauce and learn how to scale this for us, please.
Yeah. Okay. This is really such a point of differentiation for you guys. And I know we've already kind of touched on it, but like, what does building a culturally rooted brand look like in today's food landscape? What does that look like for you guys?
I mean, I think the way that we honor our tradition and our culture is in our social content. We're finding ways to share parts of our upbringing and our culture because that's a huge part of our identity. And of course, the reason the whole brand exists in general.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one way we're honoring tradition and culture. I think there's also something interesting here where our mom's chutney is actually different than a lot of other Afghan mom chutneys as well. Yeah. So there's some differences there. I mean, obviously there's like the root of it being like cilantro and vinegar, et cetera. But she's somebody who's super experimental. And so she changed that recipe 20 years ago from her mom. So it's very interesting also having elements of that. But yeah, I think, you know, your question on how do you keep tradition and culture like when you're in the food, you know, the food landscape is ultimately how you market it. In my personal opinion, it's how you show up on social, how you show up to your consumer. And then the other piece of it, just from like a production standpoint, is like how quickly a recipe can really change if you're not going to the right manufacturer.
Yeah.
Having, you know, like your foot in the ground on like what that really looks like for you. Like we cannot compromise on this flavor because that's really what makes the product this, you know? So having that like tug and pull a little bit, if we're being honest, we're still figuring it out.
Yeah. So you mentioned before that right now you're focused on like indie retailers and growing your community. What is the main year one focus? I see that you guys are opening up new, like really cute retailers. Talk to us about like who your partners are right now.
Yeah. So our main focus in year one is just product market fit. Like we want to understand our customers deeply before expanding. We had thoughts around who our consumer would look like. So sampling at events have really validated like, oh, these are the type of crowds that we need to go to. We're lucky that our first retailer was Pop-Up Grocer. They actually reached out to us, which we were stunned by. But I think it's a really great place to build brand awareness. They take on a bunch of new brands. And we felt like this would be a perfect opportunity to see exactly who our consumer is. And then obviously doing like sampling and promotions on social has been really helpful as well. And we're reaching out to other like more indie shops. Like there's Wine and Eggs here in LA and other specialty grocers on the East Coast and West Coast. And so we're just kind of relationship building at this time.
I was in Wine and Eggs a couple of weeks ago. I think I saw you guys on shelf, right? I believe you're stocked in Wine and Eggs, right?
I just dropped it off last week. So maybe you did see.
Okay, maybe not then. I could have sworn you guys were there, but I was there about, I was there about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago.
You got to stop by again and grab one.
I will. Yes. I live over here. So I live on the east side of LA. So that's my
perfect.
One of my regular spots. Okay. So indie retailers. So who are you guys working with specifically? So you're working with your Stockton Wine and Eggs. Pop-Up Grocer sounds like it was a great experiment for you. Any cute ones in New York that you want to mention, Tabby?
Yeah, we're working on a few. Eddie's Grocer in Greenpoint, which we're really excited about.
Nice.
We're also thinking through Orchard Grocer, of course, in New York. Really some of those like specialty shops in New York, which we're really excited about. But yeah, a few more in the pipeline. Like I mentioned, we really want to build slow and steady.
Yeah.
Like it's a big point for us is to build slow and steady. One, because we haven't talked about this, but we're running on our own savings accounts.
Yeah.
So we really want to be intentional about the money that we're spending. And then ultimately, like, you know, there's like natural food stores that could be a really good place for us to enter as well. So kind of thinking about what that could look like for us.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's big goals and, you know, we want to be nationwide and everywhere as soon as possible. But we got to, you know, dream big and then like figure out the steps to get to that big dream.
Sure. What have you learned about your customer, though? You know, Mina, you mentioned like you're trying to figure out like who they are and what they like and care about. So what did you learn at Pop-Up Grocer? And also like you guys have been doing events and like things like that, which I'm sure you're learning a ton about customers in person.
So yeah.
Give us some of those like insights.
Absolutely. I mean, we just sampled at Pop-Up Grocer. Main insights were people needed to hear that it was a green sauce before they needed to hear it was a chutney. That was like a very clear distinction that I noticed. The other piece was so interesting, and I'm so curious if other brands do this, or if they do, like, please let me know. I start all of my sampling or events with, are you hungry? Do you want a snack?
Yeah.
That's the way that I start it. We did it at events and everyone, it's a pattern disruptor. That question is a pattern disruptor. People are just like, wait, I think I am hungry. Like, wait, I kind of do want a snack.
Yeah.
And so it was a very interesting way to reel people in because they were like, yeah, what is this? Like, and so it was a fun way to bring people in. Found that super interesting. Finding a pattern disruptor, I think, while sampling is key, especially a product that people are not familiar with, right? It's not a beverage. It's not a cookie, right? Like, you really need to understand, like, what am I about to eat? Like, and who is this person that's asking me if they want a snack, right?
Yeah.
Which leads me to my last point, which is leading with our brand story, and people want to support small businesses, right? Like, this is our mom's recipe that my sister and I decided to make a business out of. And anybody that hears that is like, oh, that's amazing. I want to buy.
Yeah, they're like, sign me up.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened all weekend long in Pop-Up Grocer. They were like, oh, that's amazing. I'm going to go get it right now. And I was like, okay. So learning, those were some of the main insights, I think, from events and sampling. I don't know, Mina, if you had any others, but.
Yeah, it just people trying the product, they would literally try it and be like, I'll be back. And they would come back like 2 minutes later and be like, no, I want to buy it. Like the flavor that lingers on their tongue.
Addictive.
Addictive. So we were like, okay, we just need to get people to try it. The second they try it, sold, you know?
I think the vinegar does that. The vinegar makes it this like addictive thing because the sour and the tanginess. So, okay, that's great. So your like early signs are showing that people are really interested in the flavor combos. Like they really Absolutely. Are taking to it. And also everybody loves your brand story too.
Yeah, which is amazing. Like it's interesting because when we, you know, you think about the product, it's ultimately like you need to sell them on the story, right? Like you need to sell them on the story because, you know, when you're far, people are not understanding what a chutney is. And so people love to buy into story and we know that we can convince them of that. If they've literally never tasted something like this before, well, just like look at my mom. She's like adorable. And then you're like, okay, I want to support her, you know? Yeah. So there's an element of that. But yeah, I mean, the biggest thing we've learned, Danielle, is like 99% of people that have tried it have an immediate positive reaction. Like I have never seen anything like it. It's one thing to grow up with it. It's another thing to watch strangers try it and have this like visceral positive reaction with the product.
Right. Yeah. Is there anyone who has tried it who hasn't liked it? I'm so curious.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's some people that are just like, okay, it's a little too spicy for me.
Okay.
And like, that's pretty much the only feedback we'll get.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not really spicy, though. It's like, it's you know what I mean? It's like, when I think of spicy, it's like on the tip of my tongue. This, like, it's more like you feel it in your throat more. I don't know.
Different type of heat, I think. But I'm biased.
Hey, founders. Are you sick of throwing stuff at a wall and hoping it sticks? I see so many brands launch unprofitable products and they wonder why they can never get ahead and figure out how to build a sustainable CPG business. Are you ready to stop guessing and start profiting from day one? Introducing My Profit Plan. It's a 90-minute audit that slices through the noise with real tactical clarity on your specific brand and cost of goods. I'm Danielle, a CPG operator who's launched 30 plus brands, generated over $50 million in sales, and I'm handing you the playbook. No fluff, no theory, just profit, margin, and scale mapped out for your brand, and I only take on 10 spots a month. So stop spinning and start scaling the smart way. Trust me, you will not regret this. Book your profit plan at the link in the show notes and go from almost ready to ready for shelf and sustainability and profitability.
So what are some surprising things that you guys have learned just about like this whole selling process and like sales and distribution? I can only imagine all of the things that you have been surprised upon, both of you not coming from this industry. So give us a little bit of that. Like I want to hear a little like peek behind the curtain.
Oh man. I think the most surprising thing has been there isn't a blueprint. We were like, oh, we'll just look it up. Like, this will tell us, like, what it is. And we really have been shocked and surprised that we just have to, like, really just do it and figure it out. And then sometimes we'll do something a certain way, realize it's not the right way, and have to take a few steps back. So, and then try another path. So that has been really surprising to us. Another thing has been other brands have been super helpful and supportive. I think we reached out to a lot of brands because, again, this was super new to us and we didn't know anything or anyone in the business. And everyone has been so helpful and so supportive.
I know. When one brand is successful, others follow. I hate the whole gatekeeping thing.
Same. It drives me nuts. I'm like, the second I get an email, I'm like, I'll tell you everything I've ever learned in the past year and a half. What do you need to know?
Totally. Totally. I know. Well, I feel this industry, I think, historically is like notorious for gatekeeping, but it's been changing a lot over the last like 5 years, I feel like, especially with like so many more women coming into the industry, mm-hmm. which has been amazing. So yeah, I feel like that's sort of like the old way that people are leaving behind.
I think so, too. And it's just like, I think there's this element of well, if you can see them do it, you feel like you can do it. And there's something about that, that there's like a camaraderie in it. Being women in business in general already is challenging. And, you know, being a woman in food is very challenging. And so I think we're like banding together and we're like, no, if you can do it, I can do it. And if I can do it, you can do it. And there's knowledge that could be shared here, you know?
Absolutely. So are you guys talking to distributors? And or like, are you looking more at like regional chains and distribution, or are you really just like focused on the tiny doors right now? Because I'm just wondering, like, will you eventually work with bigger distributors like UNFI, KeHE, Pod Foods, et cetera?
We're doing distribution all by ourselves right now. Ultimately, we know that's not sustainable. And we're definitely looking into alternatives. It's still a ton of labor doing it yourself. But I think half of the the battle there, Danielle, is actually just not knowing, right? So we're in this element of research when it comes to distribution that we're still kind of figuring out those pieces. And so lots of me listening to these podcasts, reading anything I can to understand how people are doing it so that ultimately we can do it too. We're not totally ready, but we're getting there. So slow and steady.
I feel like you guys would be a really good candidate for Pod Foods.
Yeah.
Did you know that Pod Foods is owned by two women?
I didn't know that, actually.
I did not, all this time in this industry, I did not know that either. I just discovered it on a call with their like VP of brand, this woman, Cindy, who's awesome. And yeah, she just told me that two women own Pod Foods. And I'm like,
love that.
That's amazing. Really, we need to reach out.
I know. Yeah. I know. I need to have them on my podcast.
But yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. So we talked a little bit about fundraising and getting going. So how did Tersh get going? Like how?
Like Tabby mentioned before, we're using our savings for this. We've reached out for like grants, but it's a lot harder than we thought. Maybe because at the beginning, we're still fairly new and we're still developing a brand image. But we're definitely still doing those research and still reaching out. But at this moment, it's just us. And so we have to be really cautious about the decisions we make.
But I think that like you guys have the right approach. You're using your savings. So slow, steady growth. You're waiting for the right opportunities and you're exploring everything. You're educating yourself, which is so important, taking your time, building it on your own business. And you guys have that luxury because you have jobs.
That's exactly right. That's honestly right. The luxury is that because we have a 9-to-5 and we're getting, you know, our paycheck from there, we can be slow and intentional and we can take time to understand and educate ourselves on every piece, or at least because this is my brain, right? My brain's like, I need to know every detail before I enter it, although that's not the case. Right. But yeah, we definitely have the luxury for that right now. Eventually, obviously, like maybe we'll look into, you know, investors or loans. But again, it's based on the opportunity and how much more information can we learn. I think the past 3 or 4 months of us launching this business has just been like a game of us writing down everything we've ever learned. Like it's just so much information all at once. And so we're figuring that piece out of it. And we always say it's like me and Mina are like one thing at a time. Okay, one thing at a time. Like, let's just get over this hurdle of the thing that we're trying to work through, or let's get over this. You know, it's like one milestone at a time.
Yes, yes, for sure. So that being said, what is the long-term plan with the brand? Like, what is the vision? And it's okay, you may not know just yet, but do you guys think about the future and do you have plans of like where you see yourselves in 5 years, 10 years, et cetera?
We're really open to a lot of opportunities. We're just, again, the whole motto is about being slow and steady. If we find the right partner who believes in the mission, it could make sense. But right now, we're just heads down building and just so honored and grateful for people in our team for Tersh's success. We don't want to rush things. So a long-term goal is to expand, have as many people as possible to try the Afghan flavor in a jar. But at this moment, I think we just need to be slow and steady and focus on our short-term goals. So then we are set up for success.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can tell Danielle like the type of brains we have. Like her brain is very like logical and like needs to be like step by step, and mine's like let's go everywhere. Like just, you know, and I think that there's the balance in that with, you know, as partners together, like our 5-10 year goals is like we have a whole skew of lines, right?
And
it's the whole goal.
That's exactly what I was curious about. So like are you guys trying to be like the it girl Afghani food brand in the grocery stores with different product lines? Like, is that the vision for the company?
Yeah.
To be the Afghani siete?
Absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely. The goal is for Tersh to be this like access to Afghan cuisine, and that can look like spices or snacks or another sauce. Or I want it to feel like exactly, siete, but for Afghans. And so we have so many ideas, but we want to take things slow and prove our first skew out before we can kind of jump into that. But I mean, I want Tersh to be a pantry staple in homes across the country. I want to see Afghan food be part of the culinary conversation. And I want to see Afghans be talked about in this in a different way. You know, we talk a lot about what we want to bring to bring forward and why Tersh matters to us in the first place. Like, ultimately, you know, being Afghan is more than just the association that people may have with Afghanistan and war. And like, we feel very, you know, responsible to take on a little bit of that piece of trying to share our culture however that we can. And so we're feeling a little responsible with that. And I think part of that is in our goal. Part of that is built into our goal, right? Like 5 years, 10 years, 3 years. Like, are we a pantry staple? Because that's really the goal.
And I feel like Siete has really paved the way for that, showing these like ethnic flavors that can become pantry staples in people's house. That's why I think it's so cool that you guys are doing this with Afghani culture. The average American doesn't know what that cuisine tastes like.
Absolutely. And we're convinced they'll like it. They just need to try.
Yeah.
So, and that, at least like, we're biased in that way, but like, we definitely feel that way. It's, if we can make chili oil crunch happen and sriracha happen, and we can make all of these other harissa happen, like, I genuinely believe we could do the same with Afghan food. And so we're just the first generation to be able to do it. You know, our parents came from Afghanistan. Like, they were surviving. They were not like, let me build a food business.
Yeah.
So it's, we're taking on that responsibility and that task because it matters to us ultimately, but also because, again, we're filling a gap that just feels like a solution for ourselves, you know.
Let's switch gears over into marketing for a second, because I want to hear about what is working for you guys with your organic social. Tabby, I saw a really cute series that you've been doing with your chutney on top of different foods. The mango was a win. I think the apple was a win, right? So like, what is really working for you guys right now with your organic social? I feel like you're doing such a great job of putting yourselves out there on Instagram. I'm not sure if you're on TikTok. Like, what's getting good engagement? What are people resonating with?
Yeah, I think that showing behind the scenes, sharing more about our mom, our culture, that's working on social. It's very clear that's working. People love, like I said, to buy into a story. And so they're convinced and kind of falling in love with that aspect of the brand. And then in turn, feel excited to purchase and be part of the community. And so series that are working are absolutely trying some chutney and weird food combinations, which it's like, to my dismay that I have to do that, but that's okay. I'll take one for the team. And then sharing my mom, like that queen, that queen is getting the light of day and she will be famous from this. Like, she absolutely is like made for the camera and made to be, she's a character and she's like that in real life. Like, I think people get it because they're watching it, but like, if you know her, she's exactly like that. Like, copy paste, that's who she is. And so sharing our mom and being able to be like, this is the personality hire that we ultimately have, but is also our chef and recipe developer.
I love it.
Like, it's kind of like, it's totally working for us. And then ultimately talking about Afghan culture, that's been like huge and like really resonating with people from everywhere, not just Afghans alone. Like, there's someone that always talks about, you know, in the comments saying, oh my God, my culture also does this, or my culture does a variation of this, or my mom does this, et cetera. And so we're focused on storytelling and education on social, and I'm going to continue to take that route. Like, it's working for us. Obviously, we have a lot to learn about how to continue to market our product, but at least in the first like 5 or 6 months that we've been posting on social, this is where it's working.
And are you guys doing TikTok as well too? Or are you just showing up on Instagram?
We're on TikTok.
Yeah, we're on TikTok. I think Instagram is a stronger community builder for a brand, but that's my personal belief on how it's working for us in particular. I think every brand really differs, but from a community perspective, I feel like Instagram has a ton of really good potential and growth.
Okay, so like, your main marketing channel right now is Instagram, and then you're showing up in real life as well too. You're doing demos, you know, you're getting the product out there, you're getting people to try the product. Is there anything else that you guys are doing, or are those like your main focuses right now?
Those are our main focuses. Again, we're both on the opposite side of the country, so it is a little bit challenging to do certain things together. So I think just handling the West Coast, like sampling at grocery stores or just doing events in general has been super helpful. And then Tabby doing it on that side as well. I think that's, like we said, like, we need people to try it. And then the second they try it, they're sold.
That's our main goal.
Chat needle lips.
Exactly. Exactly. But that is really the only way we're showing up. Demos, cold emails, cold DMs to retailers, to publications, to influencers. You know, we had a really exciting moment where we shared our chutney to an Afghan influencer who has 500,000 on Instagram and 1 million on TikTok. And she posted twice about it organically and we didn't ask. Right. So it's like those are the moments that are just like, okay, this showing up authentically, it translates and people see that and they want to support that. So obviously one day, like big goals, like let's talk billboards. You know me, I'm like in the big dreaming place. Like I want billboards everywhere. I want to be in an ad, whatever, but that's where we're starting.
Yes, I love it. So sage advice that you would give to a founder just starting out, like thinking about putting this launch together over a year period, developing the product and starting to like roll it out on shelves, now manufacturing it yourself, Mina, with you and your mom. What advice would you give to her who is just starting out?
I think the first thing I would say is don't wait for it to be perfect, because at that point, you have to just start small, test it out, get feedback, and then from there, you're going to be able to expand. Like if you have if you think I have to wait till this product is perfect, and then you launch out and then all of these obstacles come your way, you're gonna be like, oh, why didn't I do that before? So I think just testing it out has been super helpful and then learning as you go.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I feel like I ask this question a lot and so many people say that, like just freaking start.
There's no better way. Throw yourself in. Take the risk. It's just, we are definitely perfectionists, both Mina and I, and we grew up in that type of household. We worked that way. We studied that way. And we just came to this like impasse where we realized, oh, this brand is not this way. We cannot perfect our way out of this one. We can't get straight A's on this project. We actually can't because we don't know anything. So it was a game of like, okay, let's just hold hands and take a leap and we're going to make mistakes and it's going to be just fine. Like we'll have calls, Danielle, where we're both like, I think we need to do a breathing exercise because we don't know what we're doing. And we're just like taking deep breaths and we're like, okay, what can we do right now? Because we're spiraling out, you know?
I know. It can get overwhelming, especially because you guys are working too, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I get that. And then, okay, like the family business though, too. Like, that's a whole, we didn't even talk about that. Like, the fact that you guys are like a family doing this together. What advice would you give to someone who wants to turn a family recipe into like a real legitimate business like you guys are doing? Because that's like a whole other layer.
Yeah. So if you're working with a family recipe, just know that there has to be tweaks. And don't take it personal. And if someone, and they will have an extensive amount of thoughts about it, like in the flavors, it's okay. Like everyone's going to have their own opinion. But as long as you're staying true to yourself, I think everything's going to be okay. So we, all of us were on the same team. We knew what we wanted to do, which I think has been super helpful. So every decision we make, it's like everyone's agreeing on it because we have the same vision. Like we all know like exactly how we want this to play out. And that has been super helpful. Working with the family, it's not easy, but as long as you have the same goal and intentions, anything can work out.
That's the piece of it. You know, ultimately, when you work with the family recipe, you're also gonna, for some reason, it like opens you up to more feedback. Like it, because they're like, well, my mom did it differently, or my dad made a different version, or my mom. So it's like, you really need to trust in your, like Mina said, trust in your vision. Like we know that this is a product that like we love and we know it's going to do well. It, not all family recipes can be turned into a food business. That's not the reality of life. Like that's just like, you know, we are persevering like through every single step. And I think one of the biggest lessons when working with a family recipe and when working with your family in general is perseverance and passion. That's really the only way your business will survive. How obsessed are you with what you're doing? Because that obsession is what's going to take you through every single obstacle, or at least that's what we think.
Resilience, getting rejected or declined and being able to just be like, keep moving.
Bounce back. Yeah.
Or deal with some kind of nightmare situation, which, by the way, happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And you just like, okay, well, we learned from that. And now we're not going to do this X, Y, and Z, you know?
Yeah.
And just being able to like get up and not get discouraged and keep going.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. Like you may not be motivated or you're going to have a bad day. You're going to feel rough about your business and you're going to feel like there's lulls and you're going to feel like, I can't do this. Like, but it's just resilience and it's just persevering. Like how much can you push yourself? And I think we're so lucky, right? Like we have each other. So when one's down, the other one can kind of pull that person up and be like, no, like Tabby, we got this. Like we can do this. And if I'm like, Mina's like, I can't do one more thing on my laptop. I'm like, no, we can do this. Like, so.
I personally think that family dynamic in business or just even in food business in general is like generally the way that I've seen it is it's really worked out because most likely you guys have been through hard shit together already. And you've probably already been through things much harder than this, most likely weathered storms that are like just as challenging as this in very different ways, right?
Wow.
But yeah. They tend to work out because you just have, you're just like used to it. Versus if you're going through this with either solo or with, say, a friend who maybe you didn't have as much history with, it's just it's very different. Right? Like it's so people always say, oh, don't get into business with family. And I don't agree with that. I see a lot of family businesses thriving these days. Like I have a couple clients in family businesses. I work with people who have family businesses and I don't know, they seem to be able to just like weather storms better.
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head there. I think that's exactly it. You're right. Like I've seen the worst versions of Mina and Mina's seen the worst versions of me, right? Your sisters, like you're going to see everything. And so you can, if we're friends, you may take that attitude personally, but we don't because we're like, she's just having a bad day and it's all good. Like, and you know, we're capable of moving on quicker than maybe if we were just friends that had known each other for a couple of years. Yeah, I think you totally got that right. That's exactly why it works.
Or even harder, a solo founder going through it on their own, right? Yeah. And like that's like super challenging as well too. Yeah. Like imagine not having your sister to like call up and like talk about all of, you know, the shit that you had to deal with dropping off samples today in New York, right?
Honestly, yeah. Our voice notes are so funny to each other. Like, it's just a shit show. Like, we're like screaming. We're just like, it's having, and then it's like some days I'm like, oh my God, this is the best day of my life. Like, I love doing this. And other days it's like, please get me out of this. Like, I don't know what we did.
What did we do? Totally.
Yeah. Kudos to solo founders. Like, I'm so impressed all the time.
I know. I feel the same way. So, ladies, where can people find you guys? How do they buy Tersh? Like, give us all the ways to find you guys.
Yeah, you can find us on our socials on IG and TikTok at GetTersh and then online at GetTersh.com. We are selling right now online and then as well as, like we mentioned, a couple of stores, pop-up groceries in New York. We're in Wine and Eggs and Olive Wine and Liquor here in LA, as well as Ink Coffee Roasters and Suburb Coffee House in Lake Forest and Huntington. So we're getting out there. A lot of access.
Yes. Yay. Awesome. All right, ladies, thank you so much for joining me. It was such a pleasure chatting with the Tersh sisters. Next time we'll have to have Mama Tersh on.
Oh my gosh.
As well too. So we'll do like a episode in a year or two from now.
See when, where we're at.
Yeah. When your business is like very different, guaranteed. And maybe Mama Tersh can come on too.
We would love that.
I can't wait to see how she'd act. So yeah. I'm very excited and we're so honored to be part of this podcast and in front of all of the people that you know, have really inspired and encouraged, honestly. Like it's made building this business feel like home and easier, being able to have access to the information that you have and you kind of just like putting your arm around us and bringing us in has felt like so wonderful. So yeah, we're excited to be here and excited for everyone to like, you know, have Tersh part of their table.
Oh, yeah. I love that. Thanks so much, ladies.
Thank you.
I will chat with you all soon.
Bye. Bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. It would mean so much to me if you like, subscribe, or share this episode with anyone who you think needs to hear. And if you're launching a brand and you need a CPG strategy advisor, visit my website to check out what we have to offer. I host free workshops from time to time. You have to sign up for emails to hear about those. And you can join Launch Lab, which is our group cohort that teaches you the four critical phases of launching your CPG brand and how to actually execute your launch quickly. We also do one-on-one advising. So if you book a profit plan session, I will assess your product profitability and recommend a package that works for you. You can book a call at itsallhappeningagency.co. You can email us at hi@itsallhappeningagency.co. And follow us on Instagram at It's All Happening Co. See you soon.